The Ward case was argued this morning and ably argued by Ms. Romero. And I extended thanks to the law school, and obviously I thank you for accepting the appointment.
Well, my apologies to the court for being unavoidably detained in Miami last night.
I was concerned that you might be waiting for the case to be called. And
well, I appreciate your courtesy.
And thank you again for accepting the appointment. The court will proceed to the third case of the day, Lewis versus Stearns. Mr. Madigan?
May it please the court. Today's case comes to the court from the denial of the habeas corpus petition of Peter Lewis, a denial predicated solely on a procedural default defense. The district court and the state acknowledged that Mr. Lewis exhausted his state court remedies. There was no consideration on the merits. Our contention is that the procedural default defense and the district court's ruling upon it represent error for two rather comprehensive reasons. One, there was no procedural default in the Illinois court, and two, the district court did not treat procedural default as an affirmative defense, as required by the Supreme Court's decision in Trest versus Kane. With respect to the former point, it is crucial to remember that no decision in the Illinois court, no order, no opinion by the circuit court, appellate court, or Supreme Court were predicated upon a procedural error by Peter Lewis. Nothing, not one. That should be the beginning and end of the procedural default defenses that the state asserts. More importantly, the concern underlying the procedural default doctrine, a judicially created defense, are concerns of comity and concerns of the adequate and independent state ground doctrine.
Mr. Madigan, okay.
Yeah.
As I understand it, there were two separate rounds of post-conviction appeals in this case. One from the denial of Mr. Lewis's original post-conviction petition, and a separate appeal from his amended or successive petition. Did Mr. Lewis consistently raise the Brady, the Batson, and the ineffective claims at each level of review in one of these two rounds?
Absolutely, Your Honor. We raised in our brief, in the reply brief on page 7 and the successive pages, the appellate court orders. And I think the state's argument with respect to this is not that the issues were not raised, but the state cites a problem with the fact that Peter Lewis had two appeals. The second appeal involved a Finley withdrawal by the public defender. The appellate court considered all of the briefing on the issue and determined that the issues lacked merit.
See, the state says that Mr. Lewis never filed a petition for leave to appeal in the second of these two rounds from the denial of his amended or successive petition. Now, you said in the briefing and in the supplemental letters that Mr. Lewis's PLA in the first post-conviction appeal referenced both of the appellate court's orders. Did the PLA make clear to the Supreme Court of Illinois that he was seeking leave to appeal from both orders? Did the PLA contain both appellate court numbers, for example? And my third, this is terrible to do to you, but do the Illinois rules permit a petitioner to file a single PLA seeking leave to appeal from two different orders in two different cases?
The answer to the first question is yes. Both were included. Both were referenced in the text of the petition. Both orders were included in the required appendix. The answer to the subsequent question is that the Illinois Supreme Court allowed that petition for leave to appeal, though it was within its rights, if it considered it improper, to strike the latter order from the petition for leave to appeal. Or more importantly, the state had the option of opposing the petition for leave to appeal because the second order was included. But actually, Your Honor, something came to my attention in reviewing the record and reviewing the 28J letters that I think is crucial. If you look at Document 7, the first answer to the habeas petition filed by the state, page 4, paragraph 14, and I quote the Illinois Attorney General, on July 9, 2001, petitioner sought leave to file a late petition for leave to appeal, see Exhibit T. It appears this petition encompassed both of the post-conviction appeals. In the Rule 28J letters, two of which were filed this week, and we believe should be stricken on that ground, and we have motions pending to strike those Rule 28J letters, the Illinois Attorney General has taken the exact opposite position, that somehow these two appeals should have been disaggregated or that they were improper. The problem is that argument is waived in the answer to the habeas petition, and there is no excuse for the appellee's failure to cite their own answer in this court, an answer which makes the Rule 28J letters and the last minute eve of argument that they've done by virtue of Rule 28J letters, it makes it improper.
Counsel, let me ask you this, and it was difficult for me to follow. It seems that your client in this case had at various times acted pro se, but was he also filing material with the court while represented by counsel?
No, Your Honor. What Mr. Lewis filed was a second. There's actually two answers to that. In the circuit court, it appears that Peter Lewis, pro se, filed his motion to amend his prior petition. The circuit court did not strike it on that grounds. Rather, specifically said, we've considered the allegations raised. It's dismissed as well. Not dismissed because it's a successive petition, which is a federal court habeas doctrine that I think the terminology is being used by the appellee to raise the specter that something was wrong there. The circuit court in Illinois considered it, denied it. On appeal, the public defender represented Peter Lewis in the first appeal, and with respect to the second appeal that Peter Lewis filed, which one can hardly blame him once you see the brief that was actually filed by the public defender, despite a habeas petition that was comprehensive, the public defender raised one issue. Peter Lewis filed the second appeal, thought it to be comprehensive, and at that point the public defender filed a motion for Finley withdrawal.
I guess that answers my question, because he was represented, but then he was filing his own material.
Only with respect to that second appellate order, right. That's correct. And because the Supreme Court PLA allowed both to be consolidated in the order before the Supreme Court, there could be no error attributed to Lewis by trying to correct the errors of his appellate counsel. In fact, in Wilkinson versus Cowan, Judge Rovner noted that the Illinois Attorney General argued in another case that when the public defender seeks a Finley withdrawal, it was incumbent upon the petitioner to file a substantive brief in order to prevent a procedural default on the underlying issues. Ultimately, this court rejected that argument and held there was no procedural default in Wilkinson. But what's interesting is that in this case, Peter Lewis did exactly what the Illinois Attorney General's argument suggested he should have done in the Wilkinson case. And yet, Your Honor, the position taken today is inconsistent with the briefing in the district court. It's inconsistent with the position the state took in the Illinois courts, where if there was a procedural anomaly, it should have been pointed out. It wasn't. The Illinois courts found no procedural anomaly. With respect to the district court proceedings, though, we think this case raises a bit of a larger issue. And the larger issue is the fact that at least on three occasions, as we've explained in the brief, the appellee should have been deemed to have waived procedural default defenses. We're happy to take them up on the merits. We think, as I've argued just now, that we can withstand the procedural defense challenges. However, it was improper for the district court to grant the appellee chance after chance to revise these procedural default defenses.
Forgive me, because you appear to argue that his PLA in the first round referenced the appellate court's order in both rounds of appeal, right?
Correct.
And what you are arguing is that having done that, that is sufficient to excuse him from filing a PLA in both rounds, right?
No.
No.
No. What I'm arguing is that he filed the PLA in both rounds. It is the
problem. By referencing?
He satisfied the requirements of the PLA. He filed a motion with the Illinois Supreme Court to file a late petition for leave to appeal. The cards were on the table that both orders were included in this petition. But the point is, Your Honor, that's not a question for this court even to consider. We have the petition for leave to appeal. We have the Illinois Supreme Court's order denying it. If there was any procedural defect in Lewis's decision to appeal both appellate court orders in one, that was for the Illinois court to decide. They overlooked it. They denied the PLA on the merits. Moreover, the appellate court in the first order that it issued, which was actually the Finley withdrawal appeal, specifically said, we have this other appeal pending, case number 00, I think it's something 105. The Illinois appellate court recognized that both were on appeal at the same time. Peter Lewis filed the petition for leave to appeal, filed a motion in the Illinois Supreme Court, which was granted, to file a late petition for leave to appeal. It encompassed both. That's the end of the inquiry. Moreover, even if this court were disinclined to accept that argument, the state has waived it. In the excerpt I just quoted from the answer, any procedural default has been waived when the state in its answer acknowledged both were encompassed in one. The central issue this court should take up, though, with respect to the district court proceedings, is what is the justification for excusing procedural screw-up after procedural screw-up on the part of the appellee for the sole and explicit purpose of allowing the state to pounce on what it purports are procedural errors committed by a prisoner in the Illinois state court system?
Well, one answer would be, I guess, that district courts enjoy broad discretion to allow amendment of pleading. So, you know, it was within Judge Kennelly's discretion to allow the state to amend its answer to raise additional instances of procedural default. I mean, that's one way to look at it, I suppose.
Well, it would be, Your Honor, except for the fact that first, Rule 8C of the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure says defenses must be asserted or deemed waived. The only way you satisfy Rule 15A with respect to amending pleadings is when the interests of justice prescribe that that should be done. What we're asking this court is for an order that says that when the state fails to file its affirmative defenses based on procedural default in the first answer, those are deemed waived. That makes sense for many reasons for the Illinois court. What we should be asking the Illinois Attorney General to do is look at the record, put all of its eggs in the basket, and present it to the district court. Let there be one order, instead of in this case, where after Judge Kennelly writes an order explaining those claims for which no defense was raised, the state then seeks to raise a catalog of new defenses. There's no justification for that. It is completely, I shouldn't say it's unfair or unjust, but to allow the state to fix its procedural errors for the sole purpose of pouncing on a pro se prisoner's procedural errors is not something justice requires. Justice requires the opposite, that if the Attorney General takes the position that procedural errors are irreversible, as it does with the entirety of the Illinois state court pleadings, then it should live by that same rule itself. Moreover, this court's cases, such for example Henderson versus Tourette, suggest that when the state puts in some affirmative defenses based on procedural default and leaves out others, that the court will deem those waived. For some reason, that doctrine appears to be lost on the state today. We think it is applicable. But most importantly, this court's decisions, which precede Trepp v. Cain, do not appear now to control. What controls is that the Supreme Court says it's a defense, you use it or you lose it. And insofar as they failed to plead it in the first instance, we ask that it should have been deemed waived. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Madigan.
Thank you.
Ms. Griffin?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Colleen Griffith with the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of the respondent. Initially, I'd like to point out that petitioner confuses what our procedural default argument is. The respondent's argument is not that the state court dismissed his claims before it based on independent and adequate state court grounds. The respondent's procedural default argument is that the petitioner never completed any of his claims through one complete round of state court proceedings. Some of the petitioner's claims were included in his first post-conviction petition. However, on appeal from that post-conviction petition, he waived one claim, which is not a subject of his habeas corpus petition. He had also filed a motion to amend his post-conviction petition, which the courts treated as a second post-conviction petition because it was filed after the denial of the first. In that petition, second post-conviction petition, he did not raise any of the claims before this court. However, on appeal from that second post-conviction petition, in his family response, he raises the issues he raised in his first PC. And he's trying to combine these two appeals by and say that it was continued through one complete round, but these were two separate proceedings, and the appellate court opinions were from two separate orders.
Well, let's see. The argument seems to be that the PLA in the first post-conviction appeal made reference to both of the appellate court's orders, right?
That is a separate basis for finding procedural default here, but in the district court here found the claims procedurally defaulted because they weren't raised in the appellate court and really never got into the issue of the petition for leave to appeal, but said if they were raised in the petition for leave to appeal, it did not revive the claims that had been defaulted in the appellate court. We are asserting that the petition for leave to appeal was from only the appeal from the first post-conviction petition, and that is an additional basis on which this court can find procedural default.
Okay, well, let me try it this way. What rule or rules would have precluded Mr. Lewis from seeking leave to appeal from both of the appellate court's orders in a single PLA?
There is no specific rules regarding consolidation of appellate court opinions. However, when one takes a petition for leave to appeal, they take it from one appellate court order. Supreme Court Rule 330 says that the caption of a reviewing court must include the number of the order from which it arises. All of the submissions before the Illinois Supreme Court only had the one appellate court order reference. But most importantly, the official report of where the denial of the petition for leave to appeal is reported in the Illinois Reporter, it shows that the petition for leave to appeal was only from one lower court opinion, which was the first post-conviction appeal.
Let me just ask you this. If we thought that Mr. Lewis's single PLA sought leave to appeal from both of the appellate court orders, and that the Illinois Supreme Court simply denied the PLA without further comment, why wouldn't that suffice to preserve all of the issues that were raised in both of the appeals?
Because the two appellate court orders were separate at that time, and as the district court found, they were procedurally defaulted at that point. You can't revive the claim in your PLA if you defaulted in the appellate court. In the petition, his first post-conviction petition, he only raised one claim on appeal. He lost all the other claims that he raised in his first post-conviction petition when he did so.
So, when he argues that his PLA in the first post-conviction appeal made reference to both of the appellate court orders, you're saying that doesn't matter, it's irrelevant, or are you saying that didn't happen?
Even if there could be some kind of consolidate, if this court would find that these two separate orders were consolidated for appeal, they still were from two separate appellate court opinions, and those opinions were from separate and distinct post-conviction petitions.
So, for instance, forgive me, but I'm really trying to get this. If both the numbers had been listed, okay, would that have taken care of the problem here?
I still believe that we have to look at as to how the Illinois Supreme Court treated the post-conviction petition. The petition for leave to appeal. And that is shown in the official reporters when they denied the petition for leave to appeal that it was only from one appellate court order. I think if they had consolidated the appeals, obviously they would have included both numbers in the official report, in the official reporters as the lower court judgment orders.
Could that have been merely an oversight by the Illinois Supreme Court? Because, I mean, those things happen.
I don't know that they do that, but again, other things support our position, that being that he did only include the one appellate court number in his captions and all the submissions before the Illinois Supreme Court. There was no motion to consolidate these two cases before the court. And just including the appellate court opinion to your appendix in the petition for leave to appeal, the respondent would submit as insufficient to say you are raising the claims properly before the Illinois Supreme Court. Additionally, petitioner cites Wilkinson to say that his Finley motion, or his response to the Finley motion, that there was a merits determination on all the claims included therein.
However, Finley motion is like an Anders in federal court, is that correct?
Correct. However, this court in Wilkinson did not say that an appellate court is considering claims not properly before it just because they're included in a Finley motion. This court found that when the appellate court chooses to affirm outright the dismissal of the post-conviction petition, the appellate court rendered a merits judgment as to each of the claims raised in that petition. The claims were not raised in the petition, therefore the Finley opinion cannot be said to have reached the merits of claims not before it. And again, the respondent does admit that we did not raise the particular procedural default in the PLA in the district court. However, this court in Momian L said the defense of waiver can itself be waived. And instead of us saying that we had waived this claim below, in his reply brief, petitioner argues the underlying factual basis of the matter, whether the PLA encompassed both orders, accuses the respondent of making false assertions and strenuously contends that the PLA encompassed both appellate court orders. It's the respondent's position that since this disputed fact is before this court may also find that the petitioner procedurally defaulted his claims by failing to properly include them in his petition for leave to appeal. Regarding the district court's allowance of respondent to file supplemental proceedings before that court, the district court issued the certificate of appealability on the question of whether it was fundamentally unfair to allow respondent to file supplemental proceedings before that court and raise additional procedural default defenses while holding the petitioner to a high standard of procedural default in state court. There is no law prohibiting the district court from allowing a respondent to file a supplemental proceeding raising additional procedural default defenses. Rule 11 of the habeas corpus rules makes the federal rules of civil procedure applicable. Rule 15 provides that a district court may permit a party, and I would submit either party, this in this particular case it was respondent, to submit amended or supplemental proceedings. And Rule 6b2 allows district courts to grant an untimely motion to an extended deadline if due to excusable neglect. There's simply nothing that precluded the district court from allowing the respondent to file a supplemental answer raising additional procedural defaults. We would also submit that there's nothing fundamentally unfair about this. Yes, petitioner is held to a high standard of raising his claims in the state court below. However, that's comparing apples and oranges. Petitioner's high standard is governed by the rules of habeas corpus proceedings and based on the tenets of comity and federalism. A federal court simply cannot consider a claim that was not properly presented to the state courts through one complete round of proceedings. In other words, this court is precluded from hearing claims that the petitioner did not raise properly below. That is why the petitioner has held such a high standard in state court. However, what the district court allowed respondent to do here, he could have also allowed the petitioner to do, was to amend his pleadings before that court. And in fact, he did allow the petitioner to file amended proceedings before that court. So there was simply no disparate treatment between the petitioner and the respondent in this case. If there's no further questions, we would just ask that this court affirm the district court's denial of the petition for writ of habeas corpus.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Griffin. Mr. Madigan?
Your Honor, there was no mention of Illinois Supreme Court Rule 330 or any defect in the Illinois Supreme Court PLA in either the Illinois courts or in the district court until late in the day. Rather, the state took the position in its answer, which I've quoted, and for some reason my sister does not explain the discrepancy between her argument today and the answer she filed then. Fagan says that the state may waive waiver. Fagan says that the Illinois Attorney General must be a master of habeas procedure. There's no justifying the procedural lenience that the district court exhibited below. With respect to the Illinois Supreme Appellate Court's decision on the Finley motion, it appears the state takes the position that the claims were already defaulted in the first appeal, so the second appeal couldn't revive them. However, if you look at Exhibit M2, which is the Finley denial, the appellate court specifically says, we have considered all of the allegations in the petition, all of the allegations in the response to the Finley withdrawal, and we deny those on the merits. There is no question that the appellate court heard the merits. For these reasons and the reasons we've articulated
on... Is that language, in your research, the standard language used in all denials?
That is correct. In Wilkinson versus Cowan, this court noted that in a Finley appeal, in a Finley withdrawal on appeal, the practice of the Illinois courts is to affirm, and in Wilkinson, this court held that that is a judgment on the merits. If the Illinois appellate court was taking the position that the claims in response to Finley and raised in the post-conviction petition in the state had been waived or were illegitimate, the Illinois appellate court would not have affirmed the judgment in pursuant to Finley, but would have instead denied relief as to the second order. That's not what they did, and this court lacks the power, and it should be resistant to reconsider the way the Illinois court handled whatever procedural snafu the state has now chosen to pounce upon.
All right, thank you, Mr. Madigan. All right, thanks to both counsel. Mr. Madigan, were you appointed in this case?
We were not, Your Honor. We intervened. We had previously represented Mr. Lewis in a civil matter.
I see. All right. Well, thank you.